I'd like to call the meeting to order of the Housing Policy, Finance, and Public Health Finance Committee. I know there'll be a couple more members coming, but we want to go ahead and get started because we've had people from the House Department here with have some information for us today, and I appreciate their coming. And we'll start out this morning, or afternoon, excuse me, with the issue dealing with the quality pork processors. Craig Acorn, I believe, and whoever else you might want to bring with you, Craig. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Craig Acorn. I'm the Assistant Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention, and Control at the Minnesota Department of Health. Although I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that as of next Monday, I will be taking a new position within the department as their Chief Financial Officer. And so I look forward to continuing conversations with this group in that new capacity. With me today is Dr. Richard Danila. He's our Deputy State Epidemiologist and a Principal Investigator on the investigation at QPP. I'd just like to say on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Health, thank you for this opportunity to meet with the committee. It's our first chance to update you on the work we've been doing since session ended. And we look forward to, me and my colleagues look forward to talking to you about a wide range of topics today. But Dr. Danila and I specifically are going to be talking about our investigation into a cluster of neurological illness at the quality pork processing plant in Austin, Minnesota, and then also give you an update on our investigation and answer any questions you might have. Before we do that, I just wanted to mention that a little background. We became aware of a cluster of workers through assistance with the Austin Medical Center and an occupational health nurse at Quality Pork Processing who were becoming ill with unknown neurological symptoms. And the characteristics of their illness is that they have a inflammatory autoimmune associated neuropathy. And what that means, if you're not a clinician, is in essence that they've been exposed they've had some sort of exposure that's prompted an immune response within their bodies. And what's happened is then that immune response has also begun attacking their nervous system. And so the press was quick to report a specific kind of neurological illness, the chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, that seemed to clinically define some of the ill workers. But that isn't the case. We're still investigating exactly what this is, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But there was some recent media reports saying it's an unknown illness, and I think that the cause is unknown, and that's what we're investigating. We understand what the symptoms are. And I would also add that we have been working very closely with quality pork processors, and they've been very cooperative with us. And they and us and the Department of Agriculture and the CDC, local public health, the Mayo Clinic, the Austin Clinic, and a number of partners have been very diligent and working very hard to try to uncover what exactly the safety concerns are that might be affecting these workers. And the plant has been very cooperative in establishing some precautionary measures that we don't know if they're associated with the illness, but we're hopeful that it's better to be safe as we proceed with our investigation, and they've been helpful in that regard. So anyway, to give you a brief chronology and an update on where our investigation is, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Danila.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. As Craig said, we learned about this in early to mid-November when a clinician called us up from Austin Medical Center. And originally it was described to us as neuropathy associated with work at the quality pork plant. So our chronic disease occupational health section began investigating. And then about a week later, we got a call from an infectious disease specialist. I'm with the infectious disease division. And this physician said, well, actually it's an inflammatory neuropathy, may have an infectious etiology as a cause. So we took over the investigation. And what we did is we went and reviewed medical records at the Austin Medical Clinic and also at Mayo Clinic. Austin Medical Center is a Mayo-affiliated clinic. And met with the clinicians and began to get a better understanding of how many cases we had and whether it was a real effect or is it some sort of artifact. And clearly we had a real thing going on here that we had, eventually we came to know of 11 cases associated with work at the plant, and then two additional cases that were reported to us that we've now ruled out. One was a resident of Austin but had onset a couple years earlier, and it was a different picture. Another one was an individual from 150 miles away that was reported to us because it was known as a farmer. And again, we've ruled that out. So we have 11 cases reported to us of people that work at that plant, all with a chronic inflammatory neuropathy. Chronic meaning that most of them, their symptoms began, they couldn't even pinpoint exactly when they began. They couldn't actually pinpoint a day or even a week, but began in a certain month and continued to get worse for 60 days or longer, making it a chronic condition before it plateaued. And inflammatory, if you look at their, actually done some specific tests, as Craig Aikens said, that their immune system is attacking their own nervous tissue, resulting in this disease, ranging from just some beginning with the tingling in their fingers, sensory changes, numbness, weakness, progressing all the way up to full paraplegia. And these are workers, so these are tend to be young, between the ages of 20 to 51. The anecdote is a 24-year-old male who, first, he was a very avid soccer player, went to the doctor and said, I can't play soccer any longer. And then he used to be able to touch the rim of the basketball hoop, and he said he could no longer even touch the net, and then he couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs. Now, there is some treatment for these conditions, and some of the workers have gotten better and have actually returned to work. Some of them are still out of work and are in recovery. And some of them will probably have permanent lifelong adverse effects of some sort, some weakness or perhaps some disability. So these diseases are, as a group, are just nebulous group, but if you look at sort of a chronic neuropathy, some of the studies have suggested it's very rare, maybe 1 in 100,000 people develop this. So we had a cluster, if you just look at southern Minnesota as a whole, because we had 11 cases, we had a cluster, if you just look at Austin, 11 cases in Austin over about a year and a half period of time. But furthermore, it was all from one workplace. At QPP, they have about 1,100 workers, and we had 11 cases. But even furthermore, it was limited to the warm side. So the warm side is where the pigs come in and are slaughtered, and then the cold side of the plant, where about half the workers work, is where they get further processed, cutting up the meat. And all of our cases were occurring in the warm side. Among the 11 cases, actually, when we then went down and began to interview the workers, 7 of the 11 workers actually worked at the head table. That's where the severed head of the pig is actually sort of going along in a conveyor belt, and someone removes the snout, someone removes the ears, someone removes some of the cheek muscle that would be used for meat. Two of them worked on back of the head removing muscle for meat, and another person harvested the brains of the animal. So again, we had a cluster even within the plant. Two of them worked at the nearby, literally just 4 or 5 feet away, offal table, O-F-F-A-L, where one was removing the lungs of the pig and the other was removing the kidneys and the spinal cord. Another one of the 11 workers was someone who wandered throughout the plant, including spending time at the head table. And then we had an 11th worker who we still haven't quite figured out yet, but she worked sort of upstream where the head was still attached to the body, and she was actually working on the tail of the animal, pulling off the tail, actually. So we've been at the plant multiple times. We've sent teams of investigators down there. We've interviewed over 120 workers, all of them that worked at the head table or the nearby offal table,
And then also we take a random sample of 20% of the workers throughout the rest of the plant. We've had a very extensive interview with them about exposures. Should say that none of the 11 cases actually none of them were even aware when we interviewed them that there were other people ill, so they had no associations outside of work. They weren't related, they weren't friends, there were no other common associations. In fact, they weren't even aware that anyone else was ill. So we're investigating what the exposures might be at the plant. We're also collecting blood samples voluntarily and throat swabs for testing. We've also wondered, well, what is it unique about this plant? We have another large plant in Worthington, and we've queried them, and they have no ill workers that they know of. We've also sent out a net nationwide. Minnesota is a large swine-producing state, but so is North Carolina and Iowa and Nebraska, Illinois. So we've sent out inquiries to those states, looking are there other workers ill from those pork processing plants in other states, and that's sort of in process. Right now we haven't heard of any other illnesses anywhere else in the country. We've been working with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta on this investigation. We've been working with swine experts around the country, with the University of Minnesota Veterinary School, the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, as well, of course, with Mayo Clinic. So it's a mystery at this point. Our leading hypotheses at this point are that since this is an autoimmune disease where the body is attacking itself, and because we see this clustering near the head table, one of the things they do at QPP is that, depending on how the market is, they will actually harvest the brain of the pig and actually sell it for food to foreign markets, typically Korea and China. Now, they don't do that all the time, depending if there's a market or not for it. And the way they harvest the brain is they that's not unique to QPP. And other pork processing plants around the country, they harvest the brain as well and sell it. At some plants, they crack the skull open and remove the brain. At QPP, they actually don't do that. They actually have a process where they stick in a pipe, basically, into the skull of the animal and use compressed air, and they actually blow the brain out, and it becomes liquefied. And they just basically collect up this liquefied brain, and that's what they then would put in a package and sell. But again, even the harvesting of brain by pressurized air is not unique to this plant. It is done at other plants throughout the country. But we are looking at that. That's a leading hypothesis, that workers would be exposed somehow. They are wearing hard hats and hair nets and either glasses like myself or goggles, lab coats, boots, and gloves. But they had their forearm exposed, and they had their mouth exposed, and you can imagine pressurized air. They are getting splattered with brain, both in their face and on their arms. So we're thinking maybe they actually are getting pig brain inside their own body. Their own immune system is developing antibody against pig brain, and that somehow cross-reacts with their own nervous tissue, setting up this process. So that's a hypothesis we're looking at. We don't want to go down any alley and get stuck, because we want to leave all avenues open. As I mentioned, we've been talking with swine experts throughout the country, asking, is there anything different about swine, at least in the Midwest? Now, QPP gets most of its pigs from either Minnesota or northern Iowa or South Dakota or Wisconsin, from about a 100-mile radius. But not exclusively. And really, there's really nothing unique, again, about the swine that are going into that plant. But we're all looking at a long list of possible swine infections, bacteria, viruses, and we intend to test our human samples that we collected against a variety of different swine infections. Again, thinking that somehow workers were exposed to a swine infection, either a swine disease-causing agent that actually causes disease to the pig, or maybe something the pigs just have that doesn't cause any disease, but now the workers are getting exposed to it. And again, that sort of cross-directs with their own nervous tissue. So we're looking at that as well. Again, every hypothesis there's a counter-argument, which is, well, there's nothing unique, again, about the swine in Minnesota. Why aren't we seeing cases elsewhere? That's where we are in our investigation as of today. You might have seen in the newspaper accounts earlier this week that a Mayo clinician Mayo Clinic physician stated that he is seeing additional cases. When we're down in the plant interviewing people, if anybody has any symptoms, we're telling them right away to get in and get seen for evaluation. So as we sort of shake the bushes, we're not surprised that we might find additional people that have been ill. And we are sort of, again, casting our net wide to find all of the possible illnesses that we can. It's a very difficult investigation, very complicated, and we have a lot of resources dedicated to it and a lot of partners, and hopefully we'll have something soon that will make some sense, because our number one priority, of course, is to protect the workers at QPP. When we first visited them, we just saw what they were doing. We said, we have no idea if this is even related to the actual cause here, but it does make sense to provide a plastic shield on the face of the workers at the head table, because we could see them getting splashed with brain. And that was done immediately by QPP. And we also recommended that the forearms, if they get these plastic coverings for the forearms, and that was done immediately. In fact, even they went even a step further. The head of the QPP said, we will stop harvesting brains immediately. As of today, we'll stop. Again, we don't even know if that's the cause, but that was very, very good on his effort to protect the workers. So we'd like to unravel the mystery, of course, so that it doesn't happen again in the future, or it doesn't happen to other plants in the country. And that's our intention. Let me stop there and be glad to entertain any questions you have.
And just to add, Madam Chair, so we recently held a news conference, which I'm sure many of you saw, where Commissioner Magnum and Commissioner Ugeson jointly talked about our investigation at Austin. And part of that is our unit within the Department of Health, and certainly our partner at the Department of Agriculture, we're very involved in food safety issues and tracking down foodborne illnesses. And we felt it important because unlike some other manufacturing setting where there might be an illness in the workforce, this was a setting that involved the food supply. We felt it important right up front to reassure the public that the food supply is safe. And to date, there have been no illness associated with consumption of pork or pork products. It doesn't seem at all associated with that. And it really has just been confined to the workers, actually in a particular part of this particular plant. So Dr. DeNoa and his staff have been very engaged in interviewing all of the workers down there. A large number of these workers are Spanish-speaking, and so we've been able to provide interpreters on staff and reassure them, provide them information that's been translated in both English and Spanish. And overall, the investigation is proceeding very well, but it's a very challenging problem. We don't know what the answer is going to be, and it may take some time for us to find the answer if we ultimately do come up with one in the end. So,
thank you. Questions from committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the workers. You just said that there was a lot of Spanish speaking. How are we handling, I don't know if this one, how are we handling being sure that we're doing some outreach into the community for workers that may in fact have been illegal or undocumented workers? Perhaps they just decided to leave the job when they started having symptoms. Are we doing any outreach into those communities to be sure that, because they might not come forward for health care because we are not allowed to deliver it. So what are we doing to be sure that we're going out into the community, in these communities, to be sure that we're catching these people that may have just left the job and are now having symptoms, aren't seeking health care because they can't get it, and, we could have a dozen more people.
Sure.
Second.
Madam Chair, Representative Mador, I'll take a crack at it and share the answer with Dr. DeNoa, but the cases are really confined to workers who are either working or have worked at the plant. And we have those employment records, and the plant is very, very cooperative, as well as the union, in helping us to locate and connect with those workers who may have a potential exposure in this case. And I would also say that we've had great partnership with local public health in Maurer County, in helping us do that kind of connection and outreach and find some of the previous workers whom we have yet to interview but would like to. We're working with them to help find those folks and get them information and talk with them. In addition, the Austin Medical Clinic and the Mayo Clinic have been very supportive as well, and they have their avenues into those communities as well. So, and I don't know if you'd want to add anything.
Madam Chairperson, Representative Medora, it is challenging. I think about 40% of the workers, 50% of the workers are strictly Spanish-speaking, so we used our interpreters to making sure that we had information sessions with all the workers prior to the press release, and we also have made fact sheets available in Spanish. But your question is good, which is, what about workers who have left? And it is hard to try to reach them. For a couple of workers that we knew about, that for a couple of the cases that actually we knew about who were no longer working at the plant, we actually worked with local public health and found an address for at least one. We were doing internet searches, everything we could think of to find addresses. For one, we found one that was still living in Austin, and we actually went knocking on doors, found the person, and interviewed them. We are still trying to find two additional workers who have left. They might have left for other reasons, voluntary reasons. They might have left because they were ill. We're just not quite sure. We're trying to find them in all the ways we can think of.
Thank you.
So just a quick follow-up on that. And those that you did find, were you even experiencing any symptoms?
Well, Madam Chairperson, we've now interviewed 9 of the 11 cases, so they were all ill. Of the 120 or so people we interviewed in the workplace, there have been, I think, 3 people that have been referred for further evaluation. They might be very early on in their illness because they're not, you know, they're weak. They have some weakness. They have some tingling, or they actually might, and they might get progressively worse, or it's possible they just have a different illness. But they have been referred on to the Austin Medical Clinic or the Mayo Clinic.
Representative Lane.
First of all, I would commend the plant for having a quick follow-up and taking care of the workers as far as the shield and not doing the harvesting anymore. Just kudos to them. Two things. Do other plants use, you said other plants do use this compressor. Do they do it the same way with the stuff flying around?
Representative, well, we're aware of right now, we're working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and with unions and with veterinarians to find out how many plants in the country actually harvest brain using compressed air. Right now, we just are aware of a Farmel plant in Nebraska that uses compressed air, and we're been exchanging information with them literally last night by email to find out exactly how they do it, how it might be different than how it's done in Austin, and to get those details. That's where we are right now. But there may be other plants that we haven't heard yet about that also use compressed air.
And my question is because, as Representative Benson reminded me, pigs are relatively close to humans in some ways. I know that we use baby pigs' livers for cleansing when a liver goes down in a human. You can actually use the pig liver. So they're very close, and would it be, I'm just thinking in terms of a reaction, you get some of that in you, it's close enough for the body to react to rather than and say, well, not quite, so start the autoimmune part. Is there any comment on that?
Yeah, Madam Chairperson, Representative, that is very perceptive. In fact, as you might know, that pigs, their heart valves are used for transplantation. So it's called xenotransplantation, taking part of a body from a different species than humans and actually using it. So actually, when we looked at the medical literature on possible swine pathogens, a lot of the work has been done at the Mayo Clinic, who has been looking at use of pig tissue, porcine tissue, for xenotransplantation. So that's exactly what kind of clued us in that maybe that's what's happening here. In fact, some of the tests they use for these neurological diseases, the autoimmune neurological diseases, are actually developed not using human brain, which is very difficult to obtain for human tests, but actually does use porcine brain. So we're looking at that as well.
Okay. And I'm sure. The other thing is that you got the information that this was actually happening through, I believe, through the clinics in Austin or someplace?
Madam Chairperson, Representative.
Did you know?
It was through a clinician who called us up and said, you know, I've seen, didn't give us a number at first, I've seen a bunch of workers, you know, have this neuropathy. That was from the Austin Medical Center. And then within a week, another call from an infectious disease specialist at the Mayo Clinic who's saying, you know, the Mayo Clinic has seen a bunch of workers with an inflammatory neuropathy. And at that same time, concurrently, the occupational nurse at Quality Pork Processors called us up and said, you know, we have a bunch of workers who have been out sick. So this confluence of three different events. In fact, Austin didn't know that the clinic was calling us, who didn't know that Austin was calling us, who didn't know the nurse was calling us, and got everybody together at the same time. So it was a really good system. And, you know, you can imagine in other parts of the country where workers might be getting sick but might be going to three or four different clinics and hospitals, no one could be putting together that they all work at the same pork processing plant.
And just to add to that, you know, neuropathy often in a workplace setting could be associated with repetitive motion injuries. And so it doesn't necessarily set off an alarm bell to hear that workers are suffering from neuropathy. And in the case of an inflammatory neuropathy, there's still a wide variety of, it's a very broad umbrella. And it takes some time to actually look into it to understand if it might be something that
this is very demanding work. And if we ask about weakness, everybody has weakness because it's very tough, hard work. But what sets this apart is obviously much further than that.
Okay, so then, evidently,
you may get my drift here because is there something that the department needs to do differently to be able to monitor workplace hazards where you have a system set up, for instance, that if a nurse in the plant is seeing something that it's obligated to immediately report, and you could cite, you know, sift through it or start the process going before we just happen to have all these people come in? Is there something that the department needs to do to be more on the alert? And, of course, we're probably a little bit more sensitive to that because of the mesothelioma things up in the Grange where it was put off rather than dealt with. Is the department on top of workplace hazards?
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, I would say that we are. We were able to catch this, and this is certainly a unique situation, probably anywhere in the United States. Currently, in our division, our infectious disease epidemiology systems track and catalog over 90 different required reporting diseases and conditions, and we receive thousands of reports every year, which we do sift through and find these trends. And then we follow up and investigate various outbreaks from all different sources, not just in the workplace, but whether they're in the food supply or insects, animals. They might be occurring in hospitals. They might be occurring in long-term care settings. They might be occurring in restaurants. And then we follow up on those with an investigation, with control measures and prevention measures as well. I would absolutely say that we're on top of that in that regard. We have a highly honed surveillance system, which we are currently improving on, and I think that in this case it actually shows that the partnerships and the communication and the systems worked for us to be able to bring this forward and actively investigate it.
Just a follow-up comment. So that you need... This sounds very labor-intensive, so if you need more people to be able to follow up on this and move on these things that come to find out if they are something that we should be alerted to, or studies to do on the basis of that, you need to come and ask for the money.
Thank you, Representative Lane. And I guess you're going to be the new fiscal person over there, the CFO, so maybe a bit of person who will be hearing from us. I did have a question kind of along the same line. It sounds like you did have a occupational health nurse who was on the ball and called, and you happen to have people going mostly to the same health care areas. But my question is kind of along the same line as Representative Lane. Right now, in terms of our OSHA requiring to report anything like this, what is your coordination with OSHA in terms of health, workplace-related health problems?
Yeah, Madam Chair. We obviously had early discussions with Minnesota OSHA and then also NIOSH, which is a national safety organization in terms of personal protective equipment for workers. And you know, we have different responsibilities Our responsibility is certainly to get to the bottom of what health issues there might be in this population of workers. And OSHA's responsibility is more general and I think more regulatory in nature. And so I wouldn't want to comment on their specific role, but I would just say that we've had excellent partnership with all agencies in state government, the Agricultural Department, the Board of Animal Health, and I think that we all play different roles in situations like this.
Maybe just a little more specific, but in terms of reporting in a particular workplace for an illness that may be related to the workplace, is there a regulation in place right now that they report to the health department? Or I'm thinking of some things that I know have been reported to OSHA. I don't know if they ever got to you folks. This is something that may be, you know, higher level of concern. But is there a requirement for, let's say, that this was scattered in some other places, there wasn't one medical facility that was mostly working with it. Is there a way that you get that information through? Is there a regulation that requires that information to come to you when it is related to a workplace?
Madam Chair, unless it's, I think, something that is required to be reported, and we have a number of diseases, conditions, and illnesses that are under, they're required under our reporting rule. I don't think there's any kind of regulation that requires that. However, I think that OSHA and other agencies and employers and certainly clinicians and providers and hospitals, when they do come across something unusual, they have in the past made every effort to bring that to our attention. So I don't know if that answered your question more specifically. So.
That's okay for now. Everything is interesting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in terms of the CDC, and I think you had mentioned them earlier, but in terms of the CDC, how do you keep them appraised? What kind of assets do they have available, and are they actively working with you in this particular arena?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they are. We call them early on. We have a good colleague there that is a neuroepidemiologist. We only have 3 neuroepidemiologists at CDC, and we called him early on for his advice and expertise. And they have offered us, testing, for example, we've been on probably 8 or 9 conference calls with CDC experts, laboratory experts, and with neuroepidemiologists explaining our findings. They've offered us resources, investigative resources as well. So we definitely have partnered with them, and as well as with NIOSH, which is a branch of CDC with veterinary experts at NIOSH. And the CDC is, although we did have a national posting of our outbreak and asked individual state health departments to query neurologists in their area about their pork processing and plant workers, CDC also is using its networks to get the word out among neurologists. They also have done a national search of hospital discharge data. It's not as timely. It's probably at least a year old, to look for any other clusters of chronic inflammatory neuropathy, and they haven't found anything. So it does appear right now to be unique to Austin, Minnesota, but we're continuing those efforts.
Yeah, follow up, Madam Chair.
And
just along a little different line here, we've had numerous alerts to the pandemic, some of those other issues that the CDC are, working on, and some of the vaccinations and those things that we as a state are responsible for putting aside. I'm just wondering, in this context, do you immediately, when you go into a situation like this, determine communicability, the ability of of this to be dormant and then become transmitted either through the air or through touch or any of that process?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a great question, too. That's one of the first things, of course, we consider is family members. Are family members sick of the workers, or could the workers have transmitted to other workers? And we have no evidence of that whatsoever. But you also touched on pandemic influenza. So the other thing we considered is, you might remember in 1976 with the swine flu vaccination program, that there was resulting increased incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is more of an acute neurological problem. So we also thought about, is there actually influenza going through the swine population that might have been picked up? And so that's, we don't believe that because we've worked with our University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, but that also is our list, on our list of long laundry list of possible agents, because we do know that pigs are infected with influenza and serve as a mixing vessel for humans, and that's a possibility.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick questions myself. Since the new measures to provide safety to the workers have been instituted, have there been any new cases? Or you mentioned that they maybe have stopped the actual harvesting as well, but have there been any new cases?
Well, Madam Chairperson, since we don't know what's causing it, we don't necessarily know what the incubation period is from the time of exposure to illness. But one thing we did look at very carefully is all of the, we have the very good employment records of everybody, and then we've interviewed everybody. And we do know that there have been some of our earlier cases, began work, became sick, and then left, either left for personal reasons or because of their illness. And then there was a period of a few months went by when we had new workers start and have become cases. So we do know that whatever exposure it was, it didn't come through like a hot lot or, a hot shipment of pigs. The exposure has either been continuous over time or has been intermittent over time. The and since this, progresses over a long period of time, it's probably too early. If, in fact, exposure to pig brain were the exposure, these preventive measures, it's too early to tell whether or not it has done any good. And the face masks going on, the plastic shields going on, could have, at the same time they stopped harvesting brains. So if we do find out it was the way they're harvesting brains, we did a good thing, even though we didn't know for sure that's what it was. And hopefully, without any more exposures, there'll be no more cases.
And Madam Chair, just to add to that, I think it's also important to realize that we've really ramped up our investigation into the workers at this particular plant. And so we're looking at people in much more detail and with much more scrutiny and much more in depth than otherwise was probably done just through the medical community. And it wouldn't be surprising that we uncover more cases when we're doing that kind of in-depth analysis.
You said, I believe you said earlier on that these workers are exposed to both brain and other organs, and I think one of them works at the tail end. So I guess I'm curious how you account for that or what you're thinking about other organs. And part of that leads to the question of you indicated that the food supply is safe. I guess I'd like to know, if you were to test the products that are being harvested, the brain and some of the other organs, are you looking at that, or how have you come to that conclusion?
Madam Chairperson, those are good questions. Clearly, the woman who actually deals at the tail is an outlier, and we're trying to explain that. When we interviewed her, she actually wasn't even aware of the head table, but it's a very close, I wouldn't say cramped, but everything's very close, physically close together. So we're looking also at ventilation system. Could it be that whatever aerosols were coming from the head table reached over her, or does she walk by the head table on her way to break or whatever? We're looking at that right now. Now, QPP harvests, they process 18,000 pigs a day. If this were something that were actually inherent to the meat, muscle, or pork itself, we think we would see something else going on. And we don't, again, it's limited to workers, and it's limited to workers in one part of the plant for the most part, except this one outlier that we're trying to figure out at this point. So, and since we don't know what the agent might be, sure, we could test pigs, but we know we'd find all sorts of infections in the pigs, not necessarily pathogens, but just like humans, they're carrying all sorts of bacteria and viruses. And have been probably for many, 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 many years, but have not caused a problem with food supply.
Other than bacteria and viruses, I'm just wondering, have you also thought about the kind of, I can't remember the exact word now for the mad cow disease. There are
Madam Chairperson, another good question that came up. Prions are the cause of mad cow disease or bovine spongiform encephalopathy or in humans, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Swine, pigs have never been known to be susceptible to any sort of prion disease. Even artificially, it's very difficult to take, for example, the brain of a mad cow and inject it into a pig and cause disease. So that would not appear to be an issue here, although, of course, we're not ruling anything out. We don't want to go down a blind alley and get stuck there.
We've also been looking at toxicology, environmental hazards, a wide range of potential issues here, and so far none of those are pointing the finger at a causative agent.
And I think I did hear you say you're looking at the ventilation system and as well, huh? Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, there was, in a different committee, there was a discussion about OSHA and whether or not that organization has sufficient personnel to thoroughly inspect all the various companies and manufacturing plants and so. Has OSHA, in the case of the Austin plant, been inspecting on a regular basis? That's question one. And the second one was, does or did OSHA have any regulations concerning the handling of products such as these swine? And if so, was the Austin plant in complete compliance?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, while Dr. Deneau and I really can't speak on behalf of OSHA's inspection record on this plant, I would just say that anecdotally, in our discussions with OSHA, they were familiar with the plant and it said they had been there numerous times. I think you'd have to consult directly with them on what their findings were and what that inspection regimen was. I think something else that might be important to keep in mind in this particular situation is that we don't know what the exposure is that caused these workers to become sick. And I think that OSHA, as an agency, is responsible for protecting workers from known hazards and known risks. And since it's still unknown at this point, I'm not sure what OSHA might have done preemptively in this case.
And Madam Chairperson, just to follow up on that a little bit, the anecdote that I did talk personally with the OSHA folks, and they were familiar with the plant, and that's mostly because of repetitive motion injuries, which are very common in this type of hot, high-speed, high-processing facility where you have a worker doing the same thing over and over again. So they're very familiar. They said they've been down there multiple times with those issues, but since this was a new issue that we don't know what the cause is, they obviously had not been there for that.
So then I would assume that OSHA most likely did not have regulations for face coverings or protect the mouth from ingesting or breathing in whatever.
That's right. Again, I think we need to ask OSHA specifically what their regulations are, but in general, I'm sure for example, the hard hats probably are a safety issue that OSHA would be very concerned about, whether it's regulatory or not. I'm not sure, but protection of the goggles probably also are for protection in general, safety protection. But face mask is not a plastic shield is not an industry standard. It's not done anywhere really, in as far as we know, in any pork processing. So in the country. So that was probably not raised to any level that OSHA would even think about.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, then are you far enough along in your investigations where making recommendations of that kind for more thorough protection would be something you would consider?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we're not far enough along to even know that, for example, it's the brain harvesting by process there to say that that's the risk. We're just not far enough along at the point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Benson, for that question. Actually, I have a follow-up to that myself, which is, why would we be waiting in the case of people being exposed to any kind of animal
excrement applied to fluids. My goodness, why in the world isn't that a standard? And I guess I'd like to ask you to talk with OSHA. If you haven't, it sounds like you have heard from them and they've only shared with you that they've looked at repetitive motion problems. But I guess I would like you to get a little more sort of a research based with them on this to find out, you know, what we do know. And I think it was such a good question. I mean, it seems like this is very hard work. It's done by people who don't speak the language of the owners or the people who are probably some of the supervisors sometimes, I suppose. And, you know, what is the standard? I guess it would be important to know, is there a standard for face and, you know, mask protection in Minnesota for meat processing workers? I guess I'm surprised that there isn't, and we should maybe find out a little bit more about whether that is the case or not. Prevention here seems to be, you know, pretty important. So, if you could just get back to us, can you do some of the checking with OSHA on that for us, please, and then talk with some more?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to have a conversation with OSHA.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the work you're doing, and I want to just echo the words of Representative Ringman. If you need resources to work with us, I think you're going to find us a committee that's going to be very happy.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for your time, and I'm sure we'll have those future discussions if needed. So.
Thank you. Okay, the next part of our discussion is with the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division, and Mayor Manning, welcome to the committee, Director. Committee members, I just want to mention what some of what we're doing today, in addition to dealing with this one particular crisis that it's come to fore, is to go back over some of the legislation that we passed and see how it's being implemented, what's happening with the bills that we did pass. And so that's kind of the direction that we asked the department to go in. And I think hopefully we've covered a lot of that here. If there are things, however, that any member we wish are in the committee or that you yourself did and you have some questions or comments about, feel free to ask the department while they're here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Mary Manning with the Minnesota Department of Health, Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division. The first thing on the agenda for me to respond to is changes to the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. Last year, the evaluation language for the disease surveillance program required us to modify the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System database and communicate with providers to include occupational and residential histories. The MCSS database has been modified to accept occupational and residential history information. Any occupational or residential history information that we find when we're abstracting a record or that is submitted to us by a provider is recorded and stored in the MCSS database. Information about this change has been published twice in the MCSS Notes newsletter. That's a newsletter that goes out to providers and pathologists that work in the cancer area. MCSS is about to publish a formal request for comments regarding rule changes, which will include the collection of occupational and residential histories. A work group will be formed to provide input and recommendations about how this should be done. Madam Chair, I'm aware that you want to ask questions on each topic before, but that's what I had planned to say about the MCSS.
Okay, if committee members have questions. Any questions for this particular topic? I guess I have one.
Okay.
Which is, we do have a meeting to talk about the implementation of this to date, and my understanding is that the department's interpretation of this change in the law is that you will accept information. You've made room in the database for accepting information when it is provided voluntarily by happenstance or whatever, but it is not, the department has not interpreted the change to indicate that providers would seek that information. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, committee members, we are having calling together a group to change our rules. And presently in the rules, people can submit information that they have, but we are bringing together a group to see how do we go about getting that information. Presently, providers don't collect that information, and how would that, so we're going to have, we have to open a rule for other issues regarding the MCSS, and we're going to work with providers and the large stakeholder group that you work with rules to see how we're going to get that information in.
Can you tell me, I know it was probably about a month or so ago that I think I heard that you were going to call this group together. Do you know when that, have you got it scheduled or?
We've been trying with schedules very hard to get that group together. We hope to have a meeting in January.
Okay. I would be very interested, and maybe we can make sure the committee all knows in case they're interested in that as well.
I'm sure committee members certainly will.
Thank you.
Okay. Now an update on the fragrance-free schools pilot project. The law required us to develop a fragrance-free schools education pilot project, working in collaboration with the Minneapolis School Board and a working group. The report is due to the legislature by February 1st, 2008. A working group has been established and has met three times. It has reviewed actions currently underway to educate about fragrances in Minneapolis schools. It has also discussed additional measures that could be included in an educational campaign, and it's in the process of finalizing its recommendations. A report from the work group will be submitted to the Commissioner of Health in January, and her review and approval will occur before it's submitted to the legislature by the deadline. Any questions about that, Madam Chair?
Any questions from committee members? Well, I have one, I guess, as the author of the legislation. How's it going? I mean, and I know you have had a number of meetings, and I think you had high school students, some of those who participated in writing the legislation, I believe, who involved, and I'm not sure who all you do have on that committee. I know we asked for an administrator and...
Madam Chair of Committee, we have three students.
You just want to know.
Just kind of generally, okay.
Yeah, not the names, just generally.
Okay,
like,
we've got three different students, a fourth that's missed a couple of meetings. We have two teachers, one from Ann Sullivan, one from the Education Service. We have an assistant principal from Patrick Henry, a school board member, and a number of other people from the community. And it's been going well. Minneapolis has been dealing with this issue. They had a work group actually in their health services area that had put out some information on their website encouraging people to be sensitive to the issues of fragrance. So they've actually had a starting point to go with and are just looking at strengthening and looking at ways to better get the word out to the schools.
I recall members that when this bill came before us, there were two of you who testified about your knowledge about this, or your concern about this kind of issue in our school. So I'm glad that you're working on it. And if you have anything in January when the report is, you think it'll be submitted, I'd be interested to see it. Enough ahead of time so that maybe we can talk about preparation for the next session. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Next, appropriations that were line item vetoed because of the receipt of federal funds. The Omnibus Health and Services Bill appropriated funding for our heart disease and stroke program. The governor's veto message stated that at the start of the legislation, it looked like federal funding for the heart disease and stroke program was not likely. But we have been notified that our federal grant had been renewed. Our heart disease and stroke program has been funded by the CDC $400,000 per year for the next 5 years. The work of this grant focuses on implementing evidence-based public health practices and collaborating with public and private sector partners for sustainable approaches to bring about system and policy change. We have also received a grant from the CDC to develop a statewide registry of patients presenting with signs and symptoms of strokes to Minnesota hospitals. This grant was funded at $563,644 per year for the next 5 years.
Madam Chair, committee members, any questions?
Well, that's a lot of money. Can you tell me exactly what it is you hope to gain by having the database and how you're going to... I'm trying to remember how much you asked for. $400,000?
Madam Chair, Representative, for your last question, we did not ask for any money from in the governor's budget. The second question, what do we hope to get out of the stroke registry? It's a one benefit of registries and looking at what occurs when people present at a facility is to see what occurred and what didn't occur. Unfortunately, in the case of stroke, although people are aware of the signs and symptoms and are also oftentimes aware of what they're supposed to do, over half people of the people that we've surveyed in some of our quality improvement projects have stated that although they knew when they started getting signs and symptoms that they should call 911, they decided not to. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. They decided not to call 911. They decided to call their brother, mother, daughter, sister, someone else. Decided to drive themselves. And then the other information that we get, so we get information about a person entering the hospital. We also get information about what types of services they get there. And the agreement, hospitals are voluntarily participating in the stroke registry. So what we hope to do on a population basis is get information to hospitals so they actually will see what some of the information that we're getting, and we can do some comparison about what's going on nationally, what's going on regionally, and what's going on in their facility. And hopefully, by the information that we get, we will motivate people to make different changes. Even the data that we've gotten just on, that we just preliminarily have gotten about people not wanting to call 911, we hope to somehow use that data to, the American Heart Association has talked about taking that data and maybe advocating for campaigns using some of their funds to get that word out, so some more health promotion type messages to get people to have a better understanding of what they should do.
A follow-up, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, are you then going to use some of this data for us to build better PSA programs for stroke prevention, and then are you doing some follow-up, say 5, 10, or whatever the cycle is for that? Is it a 3, 5 year, 10 year evaluation to find out how these treatments work? Is there some long-term vision to use the money, or is it just data collection of folks coming in today?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would hope that what would happen as a result of this is quality improvement amongst the different hospitals. And we presently have a Minnesota statewide plan for stroke and heart disease. Much of that plan is one of the main focuses of the plan, and the planning process is to work together with a number of stakeholders. So a lot of the activity that goes on in collaboration with the stakeholders involves people determining what the priorities are and how we use the resources that we have in the entire system. There are examples where we are in the plan where we are working to write curriculum for community health workers to get information out. Maybe that will be something that the partners will think needs to be strengthened. Maybe they'll determine that there needs to be PSAs, but there might also be increased training for emergency workers, EMS. So it will depend on what the data is. The grant itself is for the data collection and development of the system. And we were one of the only states to get the CDC grant. So we will be sharing this back with the CDC, and the information will be used nationally.
Okay. So thank you.
Did you, just one thing, did you say that the amount of the federal dollar was 500 and some thousand per year or over the 5 years?
Madam Chair, I said over each year, but it's over the 5 years.
Okay, so the appropriation you had was around 400 and some for 2 years. This is 500 and something for 5 years. Is that right? Since it's a smaller amount for the first biennium, are you going to be able to do the kind of, are you cutting back on some of what the original goals were or not?
We received from, Madam Chair, committee members, we received from the CDC what we requested to do the registry. So the $563,000 is what we requested from the CDC.
For the registry, and then is there something else that you're not doing because there's smaller amounts? Or, I mean, the appropriation apparently was a larger sum of money per year than what the federal government is giving us. Is that correct? Am I understanding that?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You're referring to the first amount, the $400,000 per year that we
were appropriated in the committee in the legislature and was vetoed, that amount. I was comparing it to what I understood you to say. And did I understand you correctly? And is it
the amount in the omnibus bill was $200,000
mm-hmm.
that was appropriated by this committee.
Oh, okay. It wasn't
okay.
$400,000.
Okay.
So we're doing. Okay, fine. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Madam Chair, the next piece is mesothelioma. Last Friday, we released an analysis of 58 cases of taconite miners who have been diagnosed with mesothelioma. Key findings of the analysis include that almost one-fourth of the 58 workers were employed in the industry for less than 1 year, while over a fourth were employed for 30 years or more. All but one of the miners who developed mesothelioma were diagnosed 30 years or more after they first went to work in the industry. In five of the cases, the time lag was 60 years or longer. The miners worked in locations scattered across the Iron Range, including all but one of seven mining operations that were active during the period that they were employed. The exception is Inland Steel, which employed only 618 of the 72,000 miners in the group being followed by MDH. Only three of the 58 miners ever worked at the former Conwed plant in Cloquet. This is a plant where they manufactured asbestos ceiling tiles from 1958 until 1974. The Conwed facility is believed to have contributed significantly to the elevated mesothelioma rates in northeastern Minnesota, and accounting for 25 cases of illness among the 5,200 people who worked there.
Madam Chair, committee members. Any questions from committee members? I know that you're working closely with the University of Minnesota group there, and I recently received a report from them. I presume it's an ongoing, you're continuing to work with them regularly, and this committee at some point can get that report through the Department of Health as well, correct?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, we are working very closely with the University of Minnesota, and we will, as we get more information, continue to give updates.
Representative Schumper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manning, I sat in at the hearing this summer over in the Capitol on this issue, and this one statement in your report here, it says, we currently have no scientific confirmation of that theory. That is, the theory that mesothelioma came from taconite dust. There isn't any scientific documentation or at least strong evidence or likelihood of that? I mean, that's a pretty absolute statement. It seems to me, I thought I heard a lot of scientific information talked about, maybe not absolutely conclusive yet, but that's an incredible statement.
Madam Chair, Representative, In the report, we said that we couldn't indict Taconite, nor could we say that Taconite wasn't responsible for mesothelioma. What we could say is that the workers and the 17 workers that we had studied previously also had exposure to commercial asbestos, which is a known cause of mesothelioma. The reason that further study is needed is because this there hasn't been anything to say definitely that taconite dust is or isn't the cause of this mesothelioma. That is actually why further study is needed.
What's being designed as subsequent study, scientific study? Can you tell us about that?
Madam Chair, Representative, one thing about the 58 workers, it allows a larger number of people to be studied and case controls to be studied to look at this issue. Unfortunately, with the higher number of cases, there's a higher power and a higher statistical power that will allow, with a case control study, occurs, to be able to control for commercial asbestos, so that we will be able to tell whether or not, in the 17 cases we looked at prior, there was commercial asbestos exposure, which is a known cause. We're hoping that with this higher number, we'll be able to tell whether or not commercial asbestos is still a possibility, or whether or not the taconite dust is responsible or not responsible for the increase in mesothelioma.
Okay, just one more question, Madam Chair. And so what kind of monitoring of currently working miners is occurring? I mean, most reasonable people, I think, at this point in time would suspect taconite dust. So is there increased monitoring of the present working people in the mines, or is there some other precautionary methods or practices being recommended for mine operation?
Jenny? Madam Chair, Committee, we don't know if the exposure is ongoing. Currently, there are recommendations for safety standards that certainly exceed those that were available in 1974. Whether those are high enough to deal with this issue, no one knows that right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, maybe you could have an update on the studies, because I recall the first and smaller study was on examining the taconite dust and to see if there was an association that they could determine just by looking at the dust how similar it was to the asbestos itself, because actually I thought that it was very similar. And then a longer study on these particular deaths, and that appears to be what some of this is, how long did they work, from less than 1 year to more than 30 years, which is an interesting thing, because there is no increased risk by longer exposure. You can just be exposed once and develop mesothelioma. So that's interesting. And I thought the third one had to do with examining the health situation for all the miners, do a very extensive health risk study for all miners of some sort. I'm just pulling this from memory. But I'm curious, I thought the first one was going to be a rather, you know, get going and find out about examine the taconite dust.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Stein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. John Stein with Environmental Health Division. Representative Lane, there are two additional studies being anticipated, one that the University of Minnesota and Natural Resources Research Institute is conducting to evaluate the fiber-like content of the iron ore and of the waste rock products that are crushed in the processing to create taconite pellets. The challenge in associating that analysis to historic exposures is it's unclear whether the dust that workers were exposed to who presented these cases is the same as what's currently appearing in mining operations. So there is a challenge, but they are trying to, as one component of the university study, evaluate the dust and fiber content of mining operations currently. Then comparing that to historic information is the challenge, and that may not be as straightforward of a hypothesis to generate. The third study, which you did reference, is the evaluation of health risks, looking at historic studies of animal studies where animals, laboratory animals, were exposed to fiber content that is of the same mineralogy and type as what is mined in northeastern Minnesota. There have been studies done over quite some time to look at exposures in lung tissues and in the pleura of laboratory animals. There is additional work that we're using, relying upon the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency staff at the Duluth office to generate an estimate of relative potency looking at those historic fiber exposures. I think what where that study is that one is still under design and is being developed. We expect to be in a position during the next legislative session to brief you on what a study of that type would cost and entail in terms of duration and resources.
So just to clarify for myself, the study around the fibers will be in this animal study.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, yes, the fibers, there's a theory which I believe Representative Shumper was alluding to, which is that commercial asbestos is a known cause, as Ms. Manning documented. There are theories that these fibers or fragments of rock that are produced in the mining process of iron ore are similar in nature, although shorter in length than what you would think of as a commercial asbestos fiber. The theory is that the shorter fibers may have a toxic effect. So looking at the animal research that's historically been done, going back and looking at the samples and at the results of those analyses is what's going to be the subject of that third study. That then would allow us to evaluate what's the relative risk of exposure to those types of fibers, which are the more prevalent fibers found across the Iron Range, but not in all parts of the Iron Range.
You said that the miners worked all across the range, so do we know for sure that the fibers that we're talking about are across the range to some extent or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, it's a really good question. We looked at we hadn't seen the results of Ms. Manning's analysis, and there are some interesting questions it raises as to the sites, the prevalence of the workers who were exposed at different sites where they worked. And there are differences in the mineralogy and the content of the rock at those different locations. So we have some additional questions and research ideas that we'd like to explore. And we just looked at that information last week with our friends at the U.S. EPA, and they were similarly trying to draw some distinctions between the workforce and the exposure to different types of rock that were present in those different mining facilities. Some of the workers worked at multiple locations. Some workers did not work at multiple locations, and that's going to be an interesting distinction to try to look at the data and see what it might suggest.
Mm-hmm. Just a final comment is as we approach the Austin plant, there's something that is causing a reaction, and here we have a lot more people over a lot more period of time, and it will continue as we start another mine up there. Mm-hmm. It'll go all the way to producing steel. We got to know, and we currently have no scientific confirmation of that theory. because we've never studied it. So again, resources necessary to do this, you need to ask, you need to do.
Madam Chair, Ms. Manning, and Mr. Stein, my comment is sort of on the same as Representative Lane. Do you have any rough timeline as to when these studies will be completed? This issue reminds me of so much of the atrazine issue, where things are just studied and studied and studied forever, and nobody ever comes up with anything conclusive. I mean, are we looking at another 10 years of study on mesothelioma before somebody comes up and says something definitive? Is that what the design of these studies look like? 5-year, 10-year studies?
Madam Chair, Representative, the protocols that are developed between the university and staff at the Minnesota Health Department are a 3 to 5 year timeline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Trumper, the study of the fibers and the historic look at animal exposures is an 18-month to 24-month right. study.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to ask similar questions to the ones I did before the other group. First of all, is it correct to say that exposure to asbestos-like materials or asbestos, a single or a very limited exposure, can lead to this disease? That's the first question. And if the answer is yes to that, then the second question is, are the mining companies or the processors taking precautionary steps now to protect their employees to a greater extent than those companies did in the past when this problem developed?
Madam Chair, Representative, to your first question, we know that exposure, single exposure to commercial asbestos, one time brief, can be a cause for mesothelioma. So that's the answer to your first question. To your second question, we do know that there are greater safety protections being afforded to employees now than there were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. If there are enough, we do not know.
Representative Benson.
So just to follow up then, have you monitored or evaluated these increased safety precautions, and professionally, would you say you are comfortable with them at the present? And if not, are you proposing to whomever that more precautionary measures be taken? I just don't want us coming back in 5 years after this issue is completed and have another 50-some people on the way to a terrible death sentence again on the grounds that we do not want to take more than adequate protections now. I consider human life more important than any other issue, really, and worker safety certainly would be one in this case.
And Chair, Representative, the mining industry is overseen by different occupation. It's not OSHA, it's the Mining Safety and Health Administration. There is communication among the federal agencies, and certainly I was a witness to the testimony of the iron mining community in northeastern Minnesota. We know that although there are controls and safety equipment required, that compliance with those requirements is an issue. We hear it in direct testimony from the mining workers. It's a very dirty industry. It's a very difficult industry to effectively work in and comply with the dust control requirements and the breathing apparatus that's required. You hear it, and Representative Rukovina is not here, but I'm sure you would hear him tell you the stories of people who are challenged to do their job and wear the required equipment. So there are issues. You're absolutely correct, and it is a concern that we address with Mining Safety and Health Administration. Whether how they address that is beyond our control.
Mr. Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stein, I think we were up there for that meeting up in Iron Mountain. when Commissioner Mananac was being skewered by a very unsympathetic populace. And the issue did come up that this was a provision for a study that was had been ongoing for several years, and then the 2002 legislature voted to cut the funding to that study. That's not why. They were in the process of working that study, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I think the stuff that I heard was basically they were in the works of having this study brought to fruition when the legislature cut the funding to that particular study. That's what I heard. So when that came out, it also came out that the individuals that were there skewering the commissioner were the very ones that voted to cut the funding. So when we're talking about this whole process, this is not a shortage on the Department of Health. It's a shortage on this body not proceeding with the studies, the funding for the studies that we should have had, and then isolating an individual and making it into a political maneuver to get rid of that individual. So I would encourage us to, you know, as we move forward in this, take the long-term view, which I think the Department of Health has done on this, and my hat's off to you. I think you guys are doing a great job. Please keep up the work.
So we might get a clarification on the fiscal history here, actually. Would you care, either of you care to do that?
Madam Chair, prior to my tenure at the Department of Health, I'll pass.
And
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, committee members, yes, we did have an initiative. It was called ORDIS, Occupational Respiratory Disease Surveillance System. It was working on the issue of mesothelioma. It indeed was cut. It would address the issue of mesothelioma in minors. In addition to that, it would have been working on creating a surveillance system for other occupational and respiratory diseases, which in our mind at the time was going further upstream than waiting for an issue like cancer or mesothelioma to be an indicator of a health concern.
There's a little more to the survey. They represent mine. Would you care to ask your question?
I had another one, but I'll do this one first. Was ORDIS specifically going to look at whether the taconite dust was directly related to mesothelioma?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, that was the intention.
So that you were actually beginning to look at the taconite dust itself, the fibers, and the connection to mesothelioma.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, we would have been able to proceed with the case control that would have helped us go along that line.
Okay, then back to my other thing is that when you were talking in terms of the compliance to safety in the mines, you really are, in a sense, in a roundabout way, it's kind of blaming the victim because these guys, hey, they're not wearing these respirators where they can't breathe and they can't talk to one another, but hey, they're not in compliance because they're not wearing the respirators all day long, 8 hours a day. You know, that's when, in fact, the company needs to take some responsibility for better ventilation systems to suck that dust out so they're not being so exposed to it. I mean, that's part of the problem. I'm sure it's not the only answer. But, again, brought to the Austin situation, as soon as they know something, boom, we're not, I don't even care if there's a market for pig brains, we're not doing this. Whereas a much larger situation, of course, but the mining companies do not respond.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, just my reference to compliance is with the regulation that OSHA has in place, MSHA has in place.
I think it would be helpful to have maybe, I could ask the department to come back with a historical record of actually what did happen with these appropriations, because I remember some other discussion that happened as well. Up north, and some of the issues being that recommendations of the unions and others were not being respected to try to look beyond the brake mining workers, some of the commercial workers. So I guess I'd like to just ask, we don't need to take more time with that here today, but let's get a historical record straight on this so we don't have to wonder about that. Representative Schumper, you got
a... Yeah, just a real quick one. As part of your request for a historical, you were saying in 2002 this funding for this mesothelioma study got cut. Was the department at that time also expecting federal money for that study? That's kind of what the veto message was here, if I recall,
this year is that, or not this year, but the, I remember clearly last summer the commissioner, Ms. Mandernach, was talking about that time, that they were waiting to get this federal money to fund this study, and that's why they didn't come forward with the number of deaths. Now, was that the case in 2002 also? Is that why the Ortiz money didn't get approved or was vetoed or whatever?
Madam Chair, committee members, the federal funding that you're referring to was money that we were applying for more recently, 2006. We did look for federal funding for that. In 2002, the reason that it was cut was not because we expected to get federal dollars. We had explored federal dollars once the resources were eliminated, but that was not why it was cut in 2000.
Okay.
Was that Matt? Esmeralda, did you have your hand up?
No.
Chris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is some background information on page 2 of our handout, the one dated December 7, 2007. On page 2, there is some background of the study history from 98 through 2002. It might answer some of the questions that are in there about what happened between 1988 and 1996 and then the ending of the Ortiz was repealed and defunded, it says, in February of 2002. It's a second paragraph under mesothelioma among 72,000 iron miners.
Representative Lane, did you have something? Then let's move on after we get your comment.
As it says here, two studies could not be completed following the defunding of Ortiz. A pilot study in Northeast Minnesota using medical records for surveillance of occupational respiratory diseases and a mortality follow-up study of the iron mining cohort. I don't see in here, and I may just be not hearing the words correctly, how that is a study of, does the dust equal mesothelioma?
Madam Chair and Representative Lane, again, I was not here in the department at the time, so I understand what Ms. Manning said earlier, that it would allow us to further analyze, but I know that our efforts to reevaluate the historic animal data to come up with a relative risk evaluation for risk assessment purposes and then establishing a health risk limit or acceptable limit of exposure has been something that's been discussed more recently, since about 2003, 2004, somewhere in there.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, that first study that you referenced there in that paragraph was the study that would have further looked at the issue of mesothelioma. The second one there, the mortality study, is one that would look at the impact of the work environment for miners on a more broad set of diseases, more if there are other occupational respiratory issues, other lung disease, heart disease, and other health issues.
Well, then I just want to clarify my point being that the question I asked before and that you said, yes, definitely, the study to link the taconite deaths to mesothelioma was ended by the defunding of the program is not what I'm hearing now.
Representative, I didn't. What I mean to say is that if we had funding, if the funding had continued in 2002, we believe that we would have answered the question of whether or not mesothelioma is caused by the taconite dust, rather than that's what we believe we would have been able to find out if we had continued.
I would just challenge that on the basis of the second one you said is a follow-up on many diseases, and the first one was pilot study using medical records to look at it. I don't see what I was asking, and he was saying, Mr. Stein was saying that was an idea that came later after 2003. So we must have miscommunicated, because what I was asking was not what I see here as having been defunded. Maybe we're miscommunicating, so. Well, but maybe that's enough.
Well, just, I think we probably do need to move on, but let me just point out, there's nothing to have prevented the department from coming back and requesting, and the governor requesting any of these years in between, that we would have tried to go forward with this kind of evaluation and this kind of study. One of the things I would like to ask you to maybe tell us a little bit more about, very briefly, because we're going to be short on time here, or maybe I'll just share this with the committee. Having attended the update from the University of Minnesota's plans for this mesothelioma study, one of the real important things that's going to happen that I think this committee should care about is the broader community's exposure to the kinds of deaths that we're talking about here. And the families, particularly the women and the children and the families of these workers, are equally, or let me say, they're equally important to try to consider what the impact could be. And I believe that the University of Minnesota is going to go forward and include them in their study, but it's not without a bunch of prodding, I'd have to say, because we have both a worker's right to know here and a community's right to know. And so I think hopefully we will, I guess I'd like to ask the department to say whether or not you're a voice for supporting or advocating for making sure that, again, we don't just look at the workers, but we look at the exposure of the families in the community. And do you have had any position on this at this point? Maybe mention it. If not, maybe you could tell us later.
Madam Chair, absolutely. All the studies that have been discussed are important, and your issue that you're raising is important to us in environmental health because of exposures that go on outside the mining process itself. There are the concern that we would have advocated be addressed is that we be in a position to set a level for risk that is broadly applicable to the community, not only at the mining operation, but in the neighboring communities, in the backyards of the workers and so forth.
Sure, thank you.
Madam Chair?
You get the last
follow-up
point here.
Well, just a real quick follow-up. I thought there was some discussion at one point, because it was predominantly a male population, that their spouses had some exposure at home when the washing of the clothes and the shaking out of the dust. And so I just, you're on spot. Okay, thank you.
You can represent that. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
I was putting it in simple terms.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's go on. And we do have quite a bit to get through here. We may, committee members, and we may need to stay a little bit longer if we can. I'm not sure. Let's just try to move through, and maybe we can look at the report, and we'll save a little bit of the questions maybe.
In accordance with the legislation on environmental health tracking, efforts are underway to develop 4 pilot projects. The first one is arsenic, and South Minneapolis has been selected as a community for a pilot project. The specific population that will be sampled for sampled in this community is children due to their high risk of exposure to arsenic and contaminated soils. Collection of biospecimens, in this case urine, is likely to occur in the summer of 2008. For PFCs, 2 communities in Washington County will most likely be selected for the pilot. The specific communities will be determined at an advisory committee meeting next week. The collections of biospecimens, blood, and the serum of adults in this case, in these communities will likely begin in the summer of 2008. Mercury and a chemical designated planning is in the early stages presently for biomonitoring for mercury and a 4th chemical. In light of resources, the environmental health tracking and biomonitoring staff and advisory panel are considering a range of options for proceeding on those projects, including collaborating with other planned or existing activities. Any questions?
I guess I have one comment. I'm happy that this process is going forward and that the biomonitoring is occurring. I am aware that in the case of the arsenic, conclusions that we're going to be able to draw from that are somewhat limited by the fact that the body doesn't hold on to the arsenic very long. I guess I just want to have us be aware of the differences, and maybe at some point we could get a report to this committee. I know the advisory committees are working with you, but just to try to understand a little bit more about what conclusions we can and cannot draw from these, from the biomonitoring that will be happening. Hopefully there'll be more, some of the data might be more useful with with the PFCs and the mercury. Although I'm happy that the arsenic plastic evaluation is going forward, but the biomonitoring is just part of it. The public health tracking is the other part, and are you going to get to that, or is that not something you're going to report on today?
That is not something that I'm going to report on today. This is what has occurred as of.
Okay. At some point, we need to hear about the public health tracking part, which was also part of the legislation.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you go ahead then? Thank you, Ms. Diane. Is there somebody else who's coming down for the next? Oh, excuse me. Representative Benson, did you have a question?
No, I did not, Madam Chair.
Oh. Leave it to you. Okay. Thank you, Debo. Coming down. Come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the Director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. I have with me here Mitchell Davis, who is the Director of the Office of Multicultural and Minority Health, who will be giving us an update, giving you an update on family home visiting as it relates to the tribes.
Welcome family? To the committee.
First on family home visiting, this legislation provided additional funding for tribal governments and community health boards to support home visiting activities to families at or below 200% of federal poverty guidelines. Revised statutory language expanded families at risk, required additional components to program plans submitted to the commissioner, clarified home visiting program requirements, and strengthened training and evaluation responsibilities at the department. To address the statutory changes, the department established a family home visiting steering committee. Members of the steering committee represent a range of state and local partners with interest in home visiting and its outcomes. Invitees included local public health, LPHA, local public health association, the Departments of Education and Human Services, tribal governments, Head Start, and Ready for K. The steering committee has met, and two groups have been formed to discuss the training needs and the development of an evaluation plan. Work is scheduled to be completed early in 2008. During the last legislative session, additional funds were allocated to the tribes to address home visiting, and I will ask Mr. Davis to address that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I head up the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as has been stated, during the 2007 legislative session, additional funds were allocated to the tribes to address home visiting. We are using a multidisciplinary approach, which includes schools, social services, corrections, chemical health, and environmental health as partners to also help us focus this initiative. With the established tribal centers, they also have established urban centers as well, which will help uninterrupted services to be provided as our tribal members move between one service area to the other, from the reservation to the urban and vice versa. Also, community health representatives are also working with this project. They will receive training on the community health worker curriculum and also become certified. And we are currently working with the tribes and local public health, as Director Bible has already mentioned, to develop a training component to be completed within the next 3 months. And also we will be hiring a consultant to coordinate the training and evaluation component within the next 4 months.
Thank you. Any questions? Any members? Representative Lane, I think this was your bill, right?
Right. So we're only getting the report now from the tribal version of it, right? Is that home visit, family home visiting bill?
Madam Chair and Representative, my comments were meant to update you on what was happening more broadly with the family home visiting program. The steering committee has met, and the two groups are convening to develop both the training and the evaluation plans. Family home visiting is ongoing. We issued funding as it was available. The local public health departments developed an abbreviated plan prior to the committee convening, to the steering committee convening, that would map out the framework for the plans that are required. But family home visiting is ongoing.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Mr. Mitchell, I have a quick question. I think we gave you a little additional appropriation to the year division. Can you tell us if you finally use it yet?
Madam Chair, committee, relating to the TANF?
Or I thought we gave you an appropriation of
the additional appropriation. Yes. That's a partnership with the Department of Human Services and also the Office of Minority Health, Minnesota Department of Health, to work with the Health Disparities Task Force with the health plans.
Okay. Some kind of, I'd like to hear a little more about that. Thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony. Are you staying here for the next part? For the... Who's telling us about the window screening, newborn?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The next is on the window safety legislation.
Okay.
This legislation required the Commissioner of Health to provide information to parents on precautions to prevent children from falling from windows and to report on the effectiveness of the window safety program. The department has been meeting with the Window Fall Prevention Advisory Committee, that's the Department of Labor and Industry, and is currently updating the home safety checklist used in home visiting and other programs to reflect best practices related to window safety and window fall protection and prevention. The department intends to roll out information increasing community awareness regarding window safety during National Window Safety Week in April 2008.
Maybe I didn't hear you mention this, but did you talk about the relationship to the building code? I think that was part of what we were including in that legislation, correct? For the federal building?
I don't know whether that has been part of the discussion thus far, but I certainly can find out and apprise you of that.
There's quite a bit of discussion around this, because we have two major window manufacturers in the state, and they were at the table and moving. Agreements was that there would be some changes that everyone was agreeing to in terms of the building code. And I would have thought that might have been part of your discussion. If not, maybe you can check on that.
I will.
Everything else?
Madam Chair, yeah, there was a great deal of discussion on that matter. And there was almost a bill that got on the floor, and then the window people were concerned about it. It was safety screens. And they had assured us that they would be working on that, so I'm assuming that's in the mix.
Yeah, I assume so too. So maybe we'll get a better kind of look at what you put. I believe that was the way it went in compromising the agreement with the building code. We had some changes.
I was co-author on the original bill, and
yeah, you're doing a good job.
See that continuing.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything else, Mike?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if the department can get back to you to confirm that the both the large window manufacturers are working with you on this issue. I think the chair gave them a lot of latitude in the bill that came forward, and as Representative Peterson has said, and the chair, I think we're expecting that they should be involved in your discussions and be very forthcoming with some positive changes so that maybe we don't have to do something that they might not appreciate so much, but we are willing to move forward on this issue if they don't cooperate with you to work on it. Not only the building code, but the manufacturers in how they're approaching it. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you, and we certainly will ensure their participation.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative, the next that I'm going to talk about is newborn hearing screening, and I will ask Dr. Joanne Barkas, who is the new director of the Minnesota Laboratory, to join me.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
This legislation requires the commissioner to oversee the newborn hearing screening program and to establish a newborn hearing screening advisory committee to advise and assist the department on developing protocols and timelines for newborn screening, diagnostic assessments, and early intervention services for infants who are deaf or hard of hearing, design protocols for identifying children that may be at risk for delayed or late onset of permanent hearing loss, provide technical assistance to hospitals implementing the screening program and facilities conducting rescreening and assessments, and design a system for follow-up as well as evaluate program outcomes. The responsibility of implementing this legislation is in partnership with Community and Family Health Division with the labs, and I'm going to ask Dr. Barkus to say a few words.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Ms. Eagle mentioned, I'm Joanne Barkus. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the Public Health Laboratory currently has relationships with all Minnesota hospitals that care for newborns. And we're in the process of leveraging these existing systems and relationships to facilitate the reporting of newborn hearing screening results. To that end, this summer, information was sent to all Minnesota hospitals informing them of the passage of the mandatory hearing screening law and what their new responsibilities are for testing the hearing of all newborns and reporting the results to parents, to the primary health care provider, and to the Minnesota Department of Health. One of our primary goals is to ensure that these infants are not lost to follow-up. Follow-up on abnormal results is done to make sure that the infants have the appropriate testing to determine whether the initial screening results were false positives or whether the baby truly has a hearing loss. When screening results are not received by the public health laboratory, the laboratory staff members will actually call the hospitals to ask for missing information. Nationally, 65% of infants that do not pass that initial screening are lost to follow-up, which means that these babies never receive the benefits of early intervention. In Minnesota, we don't know how many babies have been lost to follow-up previously, but we do know that the results since implementing the mandatory screening in September, we started collecting information. Our results indicate that we are receiving results for more than 94% of the newborns. We are continuing to work closely with birthing hospitals, audiologists, and primary care providers to further improve this safety net. And when babies are identified with hearing loss, we immediately notify the staff in Community and Family Health Division so that they can ensure then that these newborns and their families are connected to services as soon as possible. So once we receive a confirmatory diagnosis, then Community and Family Health Division takes over, and Ms. Siebel will fill you in on their activities.
Madam Chair and committee members, infants with confirmed hearing loss have already been identified and linked to appropriate community resources. The first meeting of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee was November 29th. They'll be meeting quarterly to assist in the development and implementation of the statewide newborn hearing screening program. In addition, the department invited federal experts to Minnesota to provide technical assistance and guidance to the department's efforts. And with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Ms. Amador.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I just have to give you a kudos for this. I actually have a constituent whose grandson was identified through this program. There is no history in the family of hearing loss. The pregnancy was uneventful, and they are now receiving services, and she came to my Saturday coffee to say, "Hey, did you know about this program?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, yes, I do, and we just passed it." So the service implementation, they received the screening, they received the results within a week, they had an appointment set up, and there's already the department has just done a wonderful job. There's a whole set of steps that families feel very in control of what's moving forward and that their infant is being cared for. So you've done a wonderful, wonderful job with that. So I just want to let you know. To have it happen so soon after a bill passes was just a wonderful experience for me to have been able to let her know that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the next topic. Suicide prevention.
So last that I'm going to comment on, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is suicide prevention. The 2007 legislative session provided additional funding to support suicide prevention efforts. Since that time, the department has been in discussion with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services, and we've been able to leverage additional funding to support this effort. An RFP for a community-based grants program will be issued early in 2008, so we expect then to be able to get this money out for a community grants suicide prevention program.
Let me just say that I know I've heard from some groups that are anxiously awaiting these grants and concerned about how long it's taking, so we can tell them January?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. All right. Thank you. Unless there's any other questions, let's ask Mr. Stein to come back up, I believe. Thank you. And we're getting kind of close to the end here, but I want to make sure that we don't miss for sure what happened in terms of some of the issues with the flood relief, because I know Representative Trump came from a distance for this hearing, so maybe you could start at the end of that list and go backwards if you wouldn't mind.
I would certainly be happy to do that. Actually, I brought Ms. Bremer, Linda Bremer, the Assistant Division Director of our Environmental Health Division, to give the overview of the flood response activities, so
thank
I'll
you.
Bring her to the table to do that.
Madam Chair, I'm Linda Bremer, Assistant Director of the Environmental Health Division. I was asked to come present the update to you because I came down to Rushford and gave you the last update on what we were doing. And so I've been working more closely with these projects. As you will recall, we had three projects that were funded. The first was the private well sampling project. And that was where we're going through and doing an assessment of wells to find out what contamination there might be in wells that had been flooded. As I told you last month, we decided to sample for nitrate plus nitrite. Chloride is an indicator of wastewater, VOCs, volatile organic compounds, pesticides, and selected pesticide degradates. To date, 1,930 wells have been tested for bacteria. 581 wells tested positive for total coliform, although not as many for fecal contamination. It's interesting. Subsequent conversations with well owners indicate that the majority of wells that have been tested were not flooded. So as we were giving out bottles for sampling in the midst of the flood, it was sort of like, let's all get our wells tested. So we met a demand that was out there. Wasn't necessarily flood-related, but we got a lot of good results. Not all the wells that were tested were flooded. People took advantage of Representative Shumpers following me.
Okay. I have a question, too. Representative Shumpers, jump right in.
I don't want you to create the impression that these wells couldn't have been contaminated without being flooded. You know,
they
could have been contaminated from the aquifer.
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, I was thinking, it could have been something in the springs because we know we've got karst geology down there. So it just was interesting, the flooding from the top.
I think it's important to distinguish that. Because
to date, 78 wells are known to have been both flooded and found bacterially unsafe. So we started collecting the samples November 19th, right after I talked to you last. We've got 70 wells lined up to be sampled. One of the challenges in this project is getting permission from the owners to come in and sample their wells. As you know, sometimes people don't really want to know the answer to, is there something in my well? It happens. We do a few may, after they see their neighbors get results, they may sign on. So we're moving right along. We should have samples this month. I believe I told you before, we're expecting to write up the results of this project and have it ready for you in January.
One of the obvious questions I would have is, you know, maybe if there is some reluctance on the part of folks, I would imagine it would have something to do with being able to afford to clean up whatever is found. So I know that there's limited resources in any of our public programs, and I don't know, Representative Schumper, what you've been finding, but I am concerned about that. I know even with just some of the work we're doing around the state with trying to clean up wells, that becomes quite an issue. Representative Schumper?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manning, I just actually had a lengthy discussion yesterday at the Fillmore County Soil and Water Conservation District 65th anniversary. And, you know, these are people who are quite focused on water quality. And a couple of the one of the technicians there who lives in the Lewiston area, who lives in a rural setting or on a farm, said that they have tested their well 5 times and it still shows positive for coliform, even though they've chlorinated it 3 times. And I've talked to other people with similar situations that they can't seem to get it cleared up, even with multiple sanitization or chlorination. And so, you know, and that's why I made my earlier comment. I really think that the aquifers have been contaminated. Now, I read an article early on that there were 24 big manure lagoons that overflowed as a result of the flood. And you know, with all our karst geology, that some of that maybe got into the aquifers, and so it's going to be really tough. This is a really big issue. We had a lengthy conversation about that, and you might want to talk to the Fillmore Soil and Water Conservation people, because they are working right now with the Department of Ag on setting up a monitoring system in our area of the state for 700 wells, where they're looking primarily at nitrates. I don't think that's your program, isn't it? No. And so I advocated for, along with nitrate testing, getting pesticide testing done, because that's the other big variable here that I'm really worried about. I think we probably ended up in a lot of aquifers, not only with coliform, but pesticides. And nitrates are a really good indication of that. I'm sure you're familiar with the studies done in Dakota County. There's almost a one-to-one correlation. If you got high levels of nitrates, you got high levels of residue pesticides in your aquifers. So I hope you'll follow up on that, because that's really the people are not being able to get their wells cleaned up, you know, which means to me that it's likely in the aquifer.
Madam Chair, that's actually a good segue to the second project, which is trying to clean up those wells that we did. You did set aside money for well cleaning and disinfection for the well drillers to go back in and recondition the well, and we have taken $60,000. We've contracted with Winona County, who will serve as an agent for Olmsted, Wabasha, Still, Dodge, and Winona counties. So the owners can be reimbursed $1,000 toward getting their well reconditioned and cleaned up. And that money, the contracts have just been signed with the other contract is $25,000 for Houston and Fillmore, late in the day.
If I might add to that, Madam Chair and Representative Schumper, that's on the presumption that bailing the well free of sediments may recover the water quality in the well. It doesn't guarantee it, however, and so your point is still valid that if it's a general condition in the aquifer, this effort would not solve that problem, and we will come to know that by attempting to bail their well mechanically or jetting the sediments out. They could have been increased as a result of the flooding. They may not have been, in which case then there's some other explanation as to what the source of contaminant in the well is.
Madam Chair, I really hope you're going to geographically locate all this well testing information, because I got a feeling there's some hot spots from just conversations I've had anecdotally that there are some places where there was some contamination occurred, and the only way you're going to find that out is if you geographically locate the well testing. Did this 1930 well test, did that include multiple well testing of the same well? Or is that all different wells?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, I believe those are different wells.
Okay.
I had 581 tested positive.
Okay.
1,930 were tested for bacteria.
Yeah.
So we did almost 2,000 samples in the region.
So about a quarter, a little more than a quarter tested positive, which is pretty high, you know. So.
Yep. Madam Chair, the third project was the indoor air investigation, mold investigation of public buildings, public and nonprofit buildings. We have approximately 14 facilities, again, who have consented to let us do the walkthrough and investigate, and staff are down in the area right now this week. In addition to that, you added on a project on, you asked about the formaldehyde in the mobile homes. That's been a real interesting project that we added on because we could not find, after you gave me that direction, FEMA had not sampled any of the mobile homes. We had told you they are different trailers than the post-Katrina trailers that are down in the south, but they are mobile homes that I believe they're a different model, but they're constructed by the same company. There are 111 of these mobile homes that have been installed in the area. We just found last week three mobile homes that had just been vacated, so we didn't have to get permission of the people who live there, and we sampled those last week. We got preliminary tests. We're doing two sets of samples. We're doing a badge sample, which is a passive sample, sort of like a radon test. You just leave it on a counter. And then we're also doing active sampling, which requires an air pump and sucking the air through a medium. So we're doing two to compare the results. We've gotten the badge samples back, and we're getting 0.1 parts per million, which is about the health level that we're looking for. We're waiting to get the active samples back. We raised an issue. FEMA had not tested these trailers, really didn't want us to, but we kept asking and kept using your directive as our reason for moving on this. FEMA is very interested in what we might find, so I don't believe you've heard the last of this one yet. We should be getting more analytical results in the next week or two. That's been an interesting side assignment, and in the meantime we are working with our health risk staff, and we're updating our fact sheets on what to do, you know, if you think you have high formaldehyde levels in your home. So
in terms of the mold, what are you finding?
In the public buildings, we're just going in right now this week. It really did take a while to line up the permissions. I did find out after I was at the high school with all of you, the school itself had a walkthrough. The superintendent, who personally greeted us when we showed up for that hearing, had already called our indoor air staff. He wasn't waiting for any directive. Our staff had already been down to that high school and had walked through, and the superintendent had done a great job cleaning up the school and getting the water out, so that the high school did not have any trouble.
I believe the building we were in was K through 12, wasn't it?
Madam Chair, it was both. The K through 12 was in the back, and the high school was in the front.
Yeah.
We were in the high school gym.
I recall visiting the child care, the former child care space, which was below ground and quite a sight to see.
It's a dungeon.
Dungeon, okay. Describe it. Actually, I am concerned, you know, what we do find in that school. Those children are, you know, more vulnerable, of course, even than we adults. But Representative Schumper?
Well, if I can just clarify then, at Rushford Peterson High, the school complex has historically had air quality problems, and they couldn't get it resolved. And ironically, the flood helped them resolve that. They had a couple different companies. The first company that came in to clean up the sewage backup did a poor job, and the superintendent fired that company and called it another guy. And this guy walks in, and within 20 minutes, he says, "You've got the air flowing in the wrong direction in this school." I think, Representative Clark, you were at that conference we had. And they have now reversed the airflow in the entire school, and the air quality is immensely better. And so that was one of the few good developments, I think, of the flood, is that they literally stumbled onto this reverse airflow problem. And so, but, you know, they haven't gone, I just talked to the superintendent recently, they are not utilizing those lower rooms for child care anymore. They just decided it wasn't worth the potential health risk to the small children. So.
Thank you.
Weird stuff.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Madam Chair, I can. You want me to work backwards or pick the ones that I know are probably the more significant interests? You want to talk about water level standards next?
Why don't you take the ones that you think are most probably a good idea?
Yeah. Seeing that Representative Shumper is still here, I will move on to the water level standards. We did, you'll recall that the law required us to do a few things. First of all, was to adopt the lower of the health risk limit or the maximum contaminant level, wherever there was a discrepancy between those values. There were 11 chemical contaminants that were adjusted, where the numbers were adjusted effective July 9, 2007. And we did that by emergency rulemaking, so-called emergency rulemaking. It's a provision under the statute that allows us to quickly adopt a rule. We also then were required to initiate rulemaking for the was referred to as the 10 most commonly found or detected contaminants in groundwater. We have made progress on that. We've identified 13 contaminants, not 10. That number is 13 because of associations between chemicals where you have a degradate component of a parent compound. We use both the parent and the degradate compounds. We asked our fellow agencies, the Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and our own toxicologists at the Department of Health, Environmental Health Division, to prioritize the list of contaminants, and we have a list of 13 contaminants that we're proposing to include in our upcoming rulemaking. Those contaminants are largely pesticides as well as industrial compounds used in various cleaning of industrial equipment, dry cleaning types of operations, and other solvents of that type. We are ahead of schedule to announce a proposed rule. The law requires us by I believe March to engage in rulemaking activities. We believe we will be ahead of that and should be able to announce our intent to adopt a rule sometime in February. We've published a number of requests for comments. We've held public meetings in that regard, and we've posted a draft rule on our website. So we're being very direct in terms of how we expect to proceed, and we're gathering comments from a number of interested parties who we believe will be engaged in our rulemaking conversations. We are required to submit a February 1st report on evaluating the costs and benefits of enforcing health risk limits for public water systems that are more stringent than the maximum contaminant levels. And we're beginning to work on that report. We also did receive some funding, $200,000 for this biennium to assist us, and we did put an additional research scientist on staff to assist us in the rulemaking process.
Dr. Stein, I'm quite impressed with the work you're doing. Is the $200,000 going to be enough?
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, the $200,000 does fully cover the cost of one additional staff person. The additional cost is a little bit of money in there for the rulemaking process in terms of public outreach and convening public meetings, publication costs, and so forth. I don't anticipate needing to request additional funds to come to closure. I wouldn't say that this will be a non-controversial subject when it does go to rulemaking, however. So at that point, we will likely bring additional resources of the department to bear out of the director's office as well as our communications office. So we have staff elsewhere in the department that will assist us when we get into that part of the process. In terms of the science needs, though, research and evaluating the research on these chemical compounds, we do have staff with the additional research scientists that we hired, as well as redirecting some of our other staff's time, we believe we'll be able to publish a rule and engage in rulemaking this spring.
I've forgotten. I used to be familiar with this. Is that like a six-month time frame for the full administrative process, or is it more than that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shumpert, it depends on the nature and degree of the controversy. I wouldn't say 6 months is likely to be a time period. It's usually 12 to 18 months.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. And Madam Chair, I just had one additional question. I'm going to email to you. There was quite an interesting article in the Washington Post on atrazine here a couple days ago, and it talked about some new research information that just became publicly available. It had been done by Syngenta for the EPA, and it was just somehow released or pried loose. And I certainly hope you'll call it to the attention of your scientist who is working on this, because it's, well, you know, it's very in-depth research on the endocrine-disrupting aspects of atrazine, and I'm sure it's going to have to come into play in this rulemaking. So I will email you that, and your scientists can follow up on that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, then I'll move on to, I'm bouncing around here a little bit, I'll talk about the blood lead testing method study. This was a study that was directed to confirm or to evaluate the use of various testing methods to confirm elevated blood lead levels. And we did not request nor receive additional funding to do this, since our staff that are doing the work are funded by a grant from the CDC for this project, for the Cheddar Lead Prevention Program project. And the questions that our study will answer are whether the capillary blood test should be used as confirmatory tests in order to initiate environmental investigations and case management. Second question is whether the filter paper methodology resulted in fewer false positives for capillary tests, and then whether the state mandatory intervention level should be reduced from 15 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. And we will have a report by January 15th, which is the due date for the report. We've got a draft of that report written, and we're working with the Minnesota Collaborative Lead Education and Assessment Network, which the legislation required us to work with communities and various interested parties in developing this information. And that's the group where all of those folks do assemble, and we're using that process to get their input and feedback on the study.
Well, Ms. Stein, just one quick comment. Reducing the intervention level to 10 micrograms per deciliter doesn't depend on just the method of testing. I'm sure you're going to be considering other things. And it seems to me over the years what all of these low, every time we've lowered it, I think starting at 60, 30, you know, 20, it's always been resource driven, right? And I presume what I would like to see in this report is tell us what we need to put into this so that we don't allow kids to get poisoned up to 15 parts per million. Tell us what that number, magic number is, so we can actually, you know, begin to decide if we're going to invest in them that way or not.
Madam Chair, we'll do our best to answer that question.
Thank you.
The last item on the list is environmental justice mapping, a requirement which directed the department to seek additional funding resources for mapping, and we have been looking for that opportunity. There has not been money made available from the US EPA for environmental justice, no additional money, and there has been none specific to mapping. $1 million was available last federal fiscal year for the entire nation, and that resulted in one project for the US EPA's Region 5, which is the upper Midwest states that we're a part of. So the funding is available for that funding was available for nonprofits, and state governments were not eligible to apply for that funding. We are aware, however, that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has assigned a half of an FTE from existing funding to work on environmental justice matters. I don't believe they're working directly on mapping of those efforts. However, as you may be aware, some of the work we're doing as a department on environmental public health tracking may assist in getting additional mapping resources together that could be applied for environmental justice purposes.
Just a quick comment on that, members. I think what your last words were absolutely right. Environmental justice mapping, I think the terminology has basically been changed to public health tracking. It seems to be a little more acceptable to the current administration. But it is, in every case, trying to look at, you know, is there a disproportionate impact on low-income people people of color, indigenous populations, to when there are toxic exposures. And so no matter what we call it, I really hope that we will go after the public health tracking federal dollars then. And I don't know, is your department trying to do that?
Madam Chair, yes. We our staff that are working on the environmental public health tracking biomonitoring program have been meeting with the Centers for Disease Control, and I was there, in fact, for a separate meeting last week where I said I thought that Minnesota would need to be added to their map, although they'd have to shade us a different color since we didn't get any federal funds. And I thought it would be useful to show the nation that one state didn't need the federal funds to make a start in its progress toward the questions asked by environmental health tracking. And they're very interested in how we're going to proceed using state dollars. So we are in contact with them. We have asked them to consider us for future funding. As yet, we're unsure whether we'll be eligible or whether money will be available in the federal budget.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions community members have? Representative Shumper?
Yes, I just wanted to go back once more quickly to the water level. You said 11 levels, 11 health risk limits were adjusted July 11th.
July 9th.
July 9th. Yeah. Did any of that have any implication into municipal water supplies? Our cities... I mean, have you come across a case where cities are now detecting levels of these contaminants that is now exceeding the new level?
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, no, not yet. Not where it resulted in an exceedance that's required some intervention at a municipal system.
But there should be some testing ongoing.
There is, yes, Representative Shumper, there is ongoing testing quarterly sampling or more frequent sampling depending upon population and size of the municipal system. What has happened is there has not been an exceedance that's required any intervention.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Just two final things, committee members. First of all, thank you all for staying a little bit later. I think it was very worthwhile, and thank you to the health department for coming with us. I realize that this is our first meeting that our new committee legislative assistant, Jake Johnson, has been that we've had at the Capitol, so I just wanted to welcome Jake and make sure that you all know him and feel free to call him, and he's already been working really hard. Really appreciate that. The other thing is there's an invitation given to us on Thursday, December 20th, so a week from today. There's going to be a homeless memorial march and service, and this is the march is starting in Hennepin County and looks like at the Government Center and goes to Simpson United Methodist Church, which is where this committee visited some time ago. And so we're all invited, and I'd like to encourage you. I've gone to this service before. It's very, it's a very moving service, and the idea is to honor those folks and remember those folks who, because they're homeless, have not survived on the streets. So this is to honor those people who have died while they've been homeless. Again, it's Thursday, December 20th, and I could always see and have some more cards, I believe postcards, if any of us would like to get the exact route of the walk or the time of the meal, which will be after the service at the Simpson Church. Thank you, members. And then if there's no further questions, the meeting is adjourned.